You're listening to the Strong Towns Podcast.
Hey, everybody, this is Chuck Marone. Welcome back to the Strong Towns Podcast. I think that the only guest that we've had on more than once here has been my friend Joe Minicozzi, except for the guest we have today. And this is actually his third time on. You've heard me interview Sam Quinones a couple times. The first time was about, I can't remember what the book was, the first one. The last one was The Least of Us. Both interviews were hugely listened to. I got a ton of feedback on them, all of it positive. You guys really responded to his message. Sam has written a beautiful, beautiful article. Sam, first of all, welcome back to the Strong Towns Podcast. It's nice to see you. It's nice to talk to you.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much, Chuck. The first book was Dreamland that we talked about.
Dreamland, that's right.
About Portsmouth, Ohio, and a little town in Mexico where everybody sold heroin like pizza.
Yep. And then we had the next book was just about fentanyl and the fentanyl kind of revolution. There's a lot of hard truths in those books, and you approach them in a very compassionate way. I feel like conversations touched on a lot of the hard part of it. If there was any critique that I think was valid of our conversations, it was, I want more hope. Like, give me more hope, because sometimes this feels very overwhelming. Yeah, you wrote an article in the Free Press, and I'm going to read the title: "Opioids Decimated a Kentucky Town, Recovering Addicts Are Saving It." You sent me this story. I started to read it, and I got to tell you, I was overwhelmed a couple of times. Your writing is, of course, beautiful. You're a great writer. But this story is also deeply, deeply compelling. How'd you end up here? How'd you end up in Kentucky? Right.
Well, let me set the background a little bit. As I was writing Dreamland, which is about the opioid epidemic, as we understand it, doctors over prescribing pain pills, pharma companies pushing pain pills as a solution to all our pain and all this kind of stuff. And it's OxyContin and all that stuff. As I got into that, I began to think about how to, as a country, or what would be some solutions to this. I'm not a municipal development guy. I'm not a, you know, I'm just a reporter. But as time went on, I began to realize that we got into this because we wanted big, huge, magic, silver bullet answers to what are extraordinarily complicated problems, and really mostly local, very local in nature. And as I began to do that, I began to develop the idea that what a lot of places need was simply to get back to the local nature of development, not wait for the big saviors, the big magic bullet answers. Those usually came with unintended consequences that we're still paying for, that unintended consequence with the opioid epidemic, you know, that we could eradicate all human pain with one pill for every human being, that kind of thing. Crazy ideas. And I thought it was more basic, more simple, frankly, easier. It was small efforts, daily efforts of the least. That's why The Least of Us, one of the reasons I titled it The Least of Us, because I wanted to focus, the book itself focuses on fentanyl and meth, but only about 40% of the book is about that. The rest, 60%, is about really people trying to figure out ways of doing things to help their town or their street or their church or whatever it happened to be. So I was very much interested in that idea. In fact, the last chapter of The Least of Us was about how Portsmouth, Ohio, which was the focus of Dreamland, the previous book, devastated by Rust Belt problems and of course, the opioids, was coming back. And so the last chapter in The Least of Us is about this remarkable, but very, very small scale, always very insisting on this, locally based, locally supported resurgence that did not require, you know, making life good for Walmart or some big shopping mall or something. It was about local, small, micro entrepreneurial businesses forming up with the risk taking and the creativity of local entrepreneurs. So that book comes out 2021, and I still am thinking, okay, I finished two books. I really want to focus on stories that do not take 4 years to publish. I want to say, you know, something that quicker.
Yeah, I hear you.
Because at a certain point, you feel, I mean, literally, a book does feel like you're pregnant for 4 years. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Exactly what you mean.
So by chance, they invited me to come speak in the town of Hazard, Kentucky, which is in eastern Kentucky. Eastern Kentucky is the far eastern section of Kentucky. Many small towns. Largest town in eastern Kentucky is 25,000 population. Hazard's like 5,000, something like that. All around are towns that are even smaller than that. And the only way I knew Hazard was from several people who had either lived near there or lived in Hazard. And all I knew about the town was it was an opioid basket case. Right? Just a devastated town. And I was like, so I go out there with that in mind. Like, okay, I'm going to go out there and this is what I'm going to see. Because I'd heard, I think, three different people tell me, oh my God, it's rough out there, you know? And of course, yeah. In Kentucky, eastern Kentucky is viewed by the rest of Kentucky as like almost another planet. I mean, sure, I was struck by that. I'm not from Kentucky, but I was struck by how people would say, man, it's very different out there, you know?
Sam, when I read this, I'm like, because I'm a 50-year-old Minnesotan. I'm like, this is Dukes of Hazzard? Like, is that the kind of thing I'm thinking of? Like,
no, it's straight up Appalachia. It's places where the coal mines sustained life, such as the coal mines can sustain life, which is not well, you know, which is mean you retire at 45 with black lung, that kind of thing. But it did do its part. The coal mine did do its part out there. And then what happened was, of course, the coal mines leave, they shut down gradually, and pretty soon they're gone. And at that point, about that same time, as the coal mines are leaving, the opioids are being introduced in quantities that just simply boggle the mind. And those are the areas where you first seen the opioid epidemic break out: West Virginia, Southern Ohio, Eastern Kentucky. This is really ground zero for all of that. And as Mandy Fugit Scheffel told me in an interview I did with her, we would be having parties with, you know, at the bonfire and drinking beer and smoking a little pot. And then all of a sudden, almost from one day to the next, we were inundated by a relentless, unwavering supply of pain pills. And pretty soon, all our friends all got strung out on these opioids that just came in staggering supply. It's a perfect example of supply essentially creating demand out there, in my opinion, is what happened. And anyway, they went through the whole ordeal, people dying, people's lives just spun out of control, people's lives still out of control. But in time, more and more people either survived it or just weren't getting high anymore or were just avoiding it. And what you began to see a little bit before COVID started is a beginning of another tale to be told. And the tale was about local folks investing in the smallest possible little entrepreneurial idea they might have had. Apparel, you know, smoothie shops.
A little bookstore. I mean, you describe a bookstore that's like people have closets bigger than this bookstore.
Yeah, well, now the store is a little bit bigger than a closet, I would say. But yeah, initially, that's exactly what it was. And one of them was Mandy Fugit Scheffel, who is the lead character in the story I told. She had long had this idea of wanting to write. She'd long been a big reader. She was tired of having to drive to Lexington, Kentucky, about, I think it's roughly 100 miles away, something like that, to the West to get books. Keep in mind, I don't think there'd ever been, in modern memory, a bookstore east of Lexington, Kentucky, in Kentucky, you know. And so she starts this thing, and then no sooner does she start it than COVID hits. And then she gets, first COVID hits, and then she gets flooded because there's because of the coal mines, they have stripped the land there. And so the land's very hard. And so when it rains hard, there's a lot of flooding, environmental disaster, really, as the coal mines are left behind. And so she somehow weathers this. And however, crucially, it's her own kind of entrepreneurial ingenuity and desire and willingness to just work it. But also she is helped through this dire period by people in the town and outside the kind of the Hazard diaspora who hear about her story and begin to order books from her. And through that, she survives. And then eventually, yes, she transitions to a little bit larger place, which was before this very funky, cool building for a bookstore, which used to be the Welcome to Hazard building, the tourist. The interesting thing about this is that she's part of this, just the smallest little wave of people who are saying, you know, I want to do that too. And a lot of these people are either recovering or know people who are recovering. And so they begin to form this this community of entrepreneurs, but at the smallest level, they don't know what they're doing too much, right? Yep. But they're all kind of helping one another. And you begin to see business formation take hold in an abandoned downtown that really had only Subway sandwiches, bail bondsmen, and lawyers. And of course, county and you know, city government, that kind of thing. And all these abandoned buildings, and some of these buildings had been knocked down because they were disasters, you know. So you kind of have a kind of a gap tooth look to the downtown. But here come all these small businesses. Some of them are from people who come in from out of town. Joey Jones and his wife come in. They're from here, but they come back from college. They're masters in social work. They start a toy store, you know what I mean? This kind of stuff. Stephen Prosser, his wife, they come in from out of town. They start a cafe. All these little things take encouragement from each other. They watch one person do it and they say, maybe it's time for me to do that. That person seems to be doing well. I'm going to start my own thing. And so what you begin to see over a period of 2 or 3, maybe 4 years, don't think it's longer than that, really, you see all this business formation. Some businesses fold, but a lot of them stick. And now we have in Hazard, Kentucky, downtown, 43 businesses, 171 jobs, which means all these businesses, they're hiring 3 or 4 people. They've had a renewal of, I would say, a renewal of municipal government, people with better ideas, let's just say, not kind of old style ideas.
Sure.
And
there's people really vested, right?
Right. And also, but they were also, the folks before were kind of old school too, because they wanted factories, big answers to probably going to ever happen. And if they did, you know, most factories nowadays going to be largely robots, you know what I mean? So, so how big of a help it would be, it's hard to say, but it was such an interesting idea that all of a sudden these things began to form, and they took courage from each other, learned from each other. But the crucial thing in all this is that there is no money coming in from outside. There's no tourism. There's no conventions. There's no university. There's no big freeway where people just bop right off and into Hazard. It's all local money supporting these businesses, all local and all local employees. And some percentage of the employees are in recovery from opioid addiction. I'd say maybe a quarter, sounds like, of the new businesses are run by people like Mandy, who are in recovery from opioid addiction. So you're getting a town taking advantage of something I've long held, which is that a recovering addict is like a new natural resource. It's like a little bit like coal, actually, you know, it's like energy rising from decay. Someone who's viewing the world more positively, more creatively, more energetically, and certainly with a lot of gratitude for not having died and getting a second chance. You get that infusion together with a municipal government that understood a little bit better how to use the tax laws, and that nowadays a mayor's job in a small town is to go around trying to help nurture dinky little businesses like these things that were starting up in Hazard. It's a beautiful, beautiful story. And this is a story that I found thinking I would find devastation, thinking I would find decay, which is probably there too. It depends on what you want to focus on, but some of that still. But damn, I thought this was the far, far more important story to take back from the town of Hazard, Kentucky.
Let me drill down into two things. You mentioned the old school council members wanting to get the factory in. I've seen this. I've experienced this. I mean, this is like the standard approach. Ideally, we'll get GM to locate a plant here and we'll employ 1,000 people. And I'm going to say something and I want you to push back. It feels like if you got that kind of plant to open up, their ideal employee would not be a recovering addict. It would be somebody else. To me, the thing that was so beautiful about this was that if we want to call it a second chance, or if we want to call it to see that beauty rising up from the decay, it almost takes someone either who has been through it or is adjacent to it to see that beauty. The recovery you're describing is only possible in this bottom-up incremental way. It really cannot be done with a big factory or the big thing in a place that has suffered hardship like this.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it can only be done there, but it seems to be done better and more efficiently, maybe with more compassion, certainly, but like that people understand a little bit better what people are up against. And so when it's at the local, most local level, but you run into this. I spoke with Bailey Richards, the downtown coordinator. That was one of the things that changed. They hired a downtown coordinator. City government had never had and has never had a downtown coordinator. Someone whose focus was on let's repopulate, rebuild, et cetera, downtown hazards. So they hired Bailey Richards. She seems to be very good at her job. But whatever the case, her job is new. It's a kind of new way of thinking about what the town needs to do. That became part of it. Yeah, she would get comments like, we need a factory, we need something, but we don't need a toy store and a smoothie shop, we need a big factory. That's the way economic development is done from the 50s on, maybe even before then. And all of that has deserted small town America and certainly these areas, you know. And so I think there is a feeling that, first of all, it's healthier when it's done locally, it's more rooted when it's done locally. You can orient municipal government towards what those small businesses need and what other people need. And I think what you're seeing now is a fascinating change, which is to say that used to be we were going to make life safe for Walmart and a coal mine and a factory. That was the point of economic development, municipally speaking, in small towns in America. And I think you are seeing, I can't speak to how widespread this is, but it does seem to me that more and more you're seeing it, where people are saying, no, what we really need to do is make life better for local folks, for small entrepreneurs, for the smallest entrepreneurs, and from there, leverage and detonate their energies and their creativity, entrepreneurial creativity. That actually feels to me more solid. Put that way, right? You're not looking for the big, solid, magic answer anymore. You are looking for the small, incremental move towards something long-term that in 5 years will look very different and 10 years will look even more different than that. And so to me, this is one of the great, exciting things. And I, as I said, I was already thinking along those lines when I finished The Least of Us. Again, the last chapter of the book really has a chapter about Portsmouth, Ohio, and them doing the same thing, which is not far away from Hazard. It's about 150 miles, something like that. So when I came upon Hazard, I was really like ready to see that too, you know, and ready to see something different than I'd already heard of. And I also believe as a journalist, you have to be willing to completely pivot, no matter what
right.
you think.
Have your challenges assumption. Your assumptions challenged, right?
Absolutely. That's one of the beauties of the job. Not that you should resist that. It's really exciting to say, oh, wow, I thought it was this. Turns out, wow, it's something very, very different. And that's what I found in Hazard. It was a beautiful, beautiful moment, I thought. And I gave a speech. The next morning, I realized that there's a bookstore in Hazard. I'm like, what? So I hit up Mandy and I said, can you just make some couple hours for me in the morning before I leave town? Sure enough, she did. We had a great conversation. I left there thinking, this is a hell of a store. And then it was just a few months to try to flesh it out, find a buyer for it and all that kind of stuff as a freelancer. But it was exciting because it was this different way of thinking about municipal development, but one that had seemed to me very, very important to adopt as I'd written my two books about the opioid epidemic and fentanyl and meth.
You're describing a strategy that starts with The Least of Us. It's a beautiful... Let me ask you this last question. When you finish The Least of Us, the book you wrote, one of the things that is hard to deal with walking away from that is just how ravaging fentanyl is, even compared to heroin and opioids. You made some kind of statement, and I will paraphrase and you can fill it in, but the journey of fentanyl is one that ends in death. There really is not a lot of other paths and destinations when you're on fentanyl. We talked the last time about what that path back looks like. And we talked about incarceration. We talked about getting people clean. And I think there's a whole conversation there. But the part that I want to focus on is this idea of staying off of it and being surrounded in a community by other people who can help you. It feels like part of the story you're speaking of in Hazard is not just an economic development story, but it's actually a individual recovery story. I think of like a person getting up, going to a factory, coming home. as being the optimum of the older strategy. And that feels like a addiction reinforcing kind of strategy.
Yeah.
But a strategy where you've got a small bookstore, you've got a little restaurant, you've got a little this, you're hiring other people who have been through what you've been through. You're running into every day people who are supporting you, not just financially and not just part of an economic ecosystem, but hey, you've been 30 days sober. Like I'm with you. You've been 2 years sober. I'm with you. Like, let's celebrate that. How important is that to this story? Yeah. And how important is that to this whole fentanyl opioid drug addiction problem that we've been scourged with for decades now?
Absolutely. And I think that this is essential. The idea that you can feel energized for something else that's not dope, energized and feel like I'm ready to wake up and go, oh man, great. I get to go run my smoothie shop or whatever, you know, go run my, my women's boutique, this kind of thing. You feel part of an energetic community where everyone's not sitting around figuring out how to rip off the copper wire from the school district to sell, but rather everyone's thinking, hey, what's the next business idea? What can we do? How can we make this better? Long-term, it's very hard to get off of drugs when you don't have something like some purpose, some excitement, some larger goal, and feel also, I would say, part of something bigger, because addiction is you at the sacrificing everything for just one thing. And now here you are part of a larger thing. It's a very exciting thing. And it seems too that when you are part of a larger community, it's such an exciting thing and so helpful for people who are struggling with this. I tell the story in the piece about a 70 Callahan runs Hot Mess Express, a woman's boutique. She put a sofa in the store as a place for men to come and sit while women shop and kids to come and sleep while the moms shop, that kind of thing. And instead, the sofa turned into this community center unto itself. You know, it's like everyone coming by, and a lot of women with serious problems, domestic violence, whatever. They come, they talk. Everyone, this sofa becomes like this essential part of kind of what you need to move forward. I would say too that it's fascinating to me that One Town Corbin, Kentucky, used a lot of their COVID relief money to keep their swimming pool open. Because if you close a swimming pool, community swimming, it's very expensive to get it running again. So they kept it open. Why? Because it was part of that place where everybody came together, just like the Dreamland pool in Portsmouth before it got dug up and destroyed that I told in the first book. A swimming pool is a place where people come together, see each other, around each other. So much of addiction feeds on that isolation that we are plagued with in this country. And so to me, all of these things are how you begin to deal in a more societal way with the individual issue of drug addiction that is, of course, has been nationwide and been a serious issue for so long.
Yeah. Sam, I follow you on Twitter. And I try to boost everything you do. I
thank you.
You are one of the most compelling writers in America today. I try to read everything that you do. If people want to follow your work, they should go buy your two books, first of all. I mean, they're fantastic books. But beyond that, how should people get connected to you?
Oh, you can find me at my website, which is just samquinones.com. I'm on Twitter at samquinones7. I'm on Facebook, which is Sam Quinones Journalist. I'm on Instagram. Instagram's become kind of an interesting place for me to put occasionally snippet interviews, 2-3 minute interviews with people. I've inner stories and stuff like that. I'm not hard to find. And of course, my books you can find on any online store and can order them. Or you can order them if you get Sheffel's bookstore, which is called, it's called redspeckledneut.com, but red is not R-E-D, it's R-E-A-D. Redspeckledneut.com. Go to her store and you can order my books and a whole lot more and help and support a wonderful independent bookstore in Hazard, Kentucky.
That's beautiful. We'll put the link in the show notes. Sam, thanks for taking the time to chat with me. Thanks for sending me the article. Let's keep in touch.
Really appreciate your interest in my work, Chuck. It's so nice of you to have it. Such a great podcast, and I so appreciate your thoughtful questions. Thanks so much, man.
You bet, friend. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening. Keep doing what you can to build a strong town.
They know that America's one big pothole right now.
Bill, 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 Bill. That's the story.
Chuck Marone, this has been fascinating.
Who made the city?
I like you. I like your vision of the world.
The United Nations Earth Summit, Agenda 21. Yeah.